Good morning, everyone. Wonderful to be here this morning and to be in contact with all of you in this way. It's an interesting thing that when I hear a mother's or a master's voice that has been recorded, how powerful those spiritual vibrations are lifting me up. Even though time and space separates us, nevertheless, there is a connection that occurs in spirit that surpasses all such things. So let us tune in to that omniscience, omnipresence, omnipotence of God. And in doing so, we connect with one another. We do so in a higher sense than a normal human interaction. When we make God the intermediary, there is a divine vibration that goes between us, unites us, and makes us as one. This is the most wonderful gift that we can possibly give to ourselves. We do it by thinking of God, meditating upon Him, merging ourselves into His divine presence, and then we are spontaneously, automatically connected with all creation. So this is one of the great secrets in life, known by few, but one day the world will practice this and will know such harmony and peace and cooperation. Sent out a posting this morning that I would read it to you. It's entitled, Blessings, Not Luck. What do we mean when we say good luck? We are wishing somebody well, that things go his way. What does it mean for things to go his way? We all know there are times in life when everything seems to just go easier, contrasted to other times when it feels one difficulty after another is trying to stop us. Good luck means either the impediments disappear or that they are overcome. But why any impediments at all? Is it bad luck that is at fault? The same person with the same body conditioning may be walking down a slight hill, talking, smiling, laughing all along the way. Or he may be climbing up a steep incline. All talk ceases. The lungs act like overworked bellows, and he feels as though he will not make it to the top. Is the hill climbed bad luck? When we find someone who is struggling to put one foot in front of the other, we want him to have strength, endurance, have some things go his way. The individual may focus upon his own abilities. However, the thoughtful person becomes clear that every individual is connected to something higher, and events that swirl all around have a source beyond random chance. There is a creator, a God. Rather than ascribing this source to luck, you ultimately want to be blessed by the giver of all good things. Good luck really means God bless you. If you would but know it, all things in your life are a result of the law of cause and effect, the law of karma. However, higher than the law of karma, or the stars, genetics, or any other influence from the material world, is the power, intelligence, and grace that comes directly from divine consciousness. Replacing no I can't consciousness with yes I will consciousness is a tremendous step in evolution. But a giant leap forward comes in uniting individual will with the Supreme Creator's will, which makes all things possible. Light is stronger than dark. Love is more powerful than fear. Omniscience, true, and separation, false. In all ways, the presence of God is superior to anything this world offers. It is the human mind that is the battleground for these two ways of perceiving the source for overcoming, the human and the divine. years and lifetimes of survival mode makes us think we must rely only upon our own wits and capabilities. And although it becomes clear there is a divine consciousness, which is the true source of our being, past programming remains strong in feeling it is just me. Our own journey in knowing this something higher began when I was a late teen. My own decision-making and circumstances led me to a crisis of great emotional pain. In the middle of the night, I sat in the front yard looking at the starry sky, feeling my heart splitting in two in the most painful way possible. It was so painful that I prayed, God, I don't know if you exist, but if you do, if I have never needed you before, I need you now. Please help me with this pain. Immediately, I felt as if a 1,000-pound weight was lifted from my shoulders. The pain in my heart was alleviated. My rational mind argued that there was no divine intervention, but a deeper part of me could not deny it. I knew that it was. There was a momentary opening of a door to a much greater way of being. The way was slow and bumbling, but a seed was planted in the rocky ground of doubt and denial, finding good enough soil that it eventually bore a tree of realization. The most tremendous change began when I was blessed on that warm summer's night. Instead of wishing you good luck, I see, in the depth of my communion with the all-beneficent Lord of creation, that you are blessed. Most particularly, that your journey to the highest realization is greatly quickened. In that spirit, God's greatest blessings to you. Last weekend, we had the most wonderful retreat. And the inspiration for the topic is that the 70th anniversary of Master's classic, spiritual classic now, Autobiography of a Yogi, was released. It will be December of this year. That will mark the exact date. We have all been blessed by reading this wonderful book about such an incredible, remarkable God-man. When I first met Mother, I had never heard of Paramahansa Yogananda or the autobiography. It had been a few months being with Mother, and one night she mentioned a book, an autobiography. I couldn't quite remember the name, so when I stood in line waiting to give Mother a hug, I asked the man behind me, I said, what was that book that Mother was talking about, some autobiography? What? You have never heard of that before? That's what brought us all here. And so I went and ordered the autobiography from the college bookstore, and when I got it, I read it from front to back. And each year after that, I would read it every springtime. Each springtime brought to me a brand new book, in the sense that I would see things, read things, understand things in a way that I had never before. And it felt to me as if this was a new book to me, a new revelation. The depth and breadth of that book is remarkable. The stories that he tells about his own search is stunningly humble. At a time in the Western world when people rarely spoke of their feelings, Master spoke of the depth of his feeling for God, that he would cry tears in order to know God, and this is an adult man. And so he laid it all out for everyone. I think the most telling thing about the autobiography is what really stands out in highlight. Is Sri Yukteswar. His teachings, his words, his presence become something that it seems the entire book is focused upon. Initially, it was to be a book about Lhari Mahasaya, but I think Master, perhaps not living in India, could not gather all the information on the great Master, and so he wove it into the story about his own search for his own guru, who was a direct disciple of Lhari Mahasaya. And in that way, he honored Lhari Mahasaya in a most wonderful way. Because what any great master, and Lhari Mahasaya counts among the greatest the world has ever known, any great master does not care for reference to themselves as a personality. That is not the point of their life or their teaching. What they really want is for you to aspire to attain the same level of God consciousness that they have. If you do this, then they are well pleased. If you become a son of God, even as Jesus did, and in the first of John it says that we all may become sons of God. When you become a son of God, then Jesus is most pleased. He himself said that there are many who would call on his name and claim to represent his teachings. But he said, unless you live the life, unless you live the truth as he taught, then you in no way represented him or what he came to bring. You think about down through the centuries and how many of those who claim to follow in the Christ's name would rather persecute than be persecuted, would rather hate rather than love. These individuals in no way represented the Christ that came to teach universal love, universal service, a universal vision. I think it's interesting that in the teachings of Jesus and his life as it is portrayed, that he does not always, in fact, very, very rarely, does he ever say, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one may come to the Father except through me. He says that to some direct disciples. But time and again, he meets individuals, he gives them teachings, he makes no such claim. You would think if that was the only way in order to enter heaven, that he would be proclaiming it to one and all. But he does not. He gives it to his close disciples because they have been trained. They understand what the deeper meaning of this is. That Jesus, as an individual, as a personality, had merged himself into the Christ consciousness. Now to some, God is one, and you don't divide him up. And yet, we know through both cosmology from India, as well as from the Bible, and from the New Testament, that it is divided up, because once God moves out of the one individual consciousness without beginning or without end, once God becomes creator, there has to be the created, there has to be separation, there has to be multiplicity. Now, we can experience multiplicity without experiencing separation from God. True, we feel ourselves to be an individual I. But in addition to that, we are more than that. We are also connected with the universal I, or that which experiences itself as one with everything that is. Now, the fact that most people don't experience life that way only means that they haven't realized it consciously, not that it's not true. The fact that something is unrecognized doesn't mean that it's not true. Not that long ago, scientists were thinking of the number of galaxies, and they tried to look out through telescopes and of various kinds, and to try to determine how many galaxies. Now, each galaxy is filled with millions and millions of stars, solar systems. How many planets can only go uncounted? Their best estimate was that there were somewhere between 1 and 2 billion galaxies in the universe. 1 to 2 billion galaxies. Recently, with the Hubble telescope and other ways and new mathematics, they now estimate that that's 10 times that much. That it's 2 trillion galaxies. Each with millions and millions of solar systems, each with their own planets, each with their own capacity for life. And so you think of man's knowledge and how man's knowledge is constantly expanding, constantly adjusting. And you think of the vast, vast numbers, and how can there be a creator who contains all of that? And yet, the great mystics, the great saints, those realized individuals have proclaimed that that is true. There is a creator, and that creator is vast beyond creation itself, vast beyond this universe. Master writes about many island universes. So there are thousands and millions of island universes. It just becomes tremendous. And then Sri Yukteswar talks about how all of physical creation is like a little solid basket under an enormous balloon of the astral worlds. And so however vast the material creations are, this astral creation is much, much bigger, much brighter, much more enlightened on the whole. There are those regions that are darkened by warfare and by those souls that find they are drawn to that kind of living. You see, it is our own desire nature that draws us to wherever we go. If your desire nature is strong for the astral region, and that's what you crave when you leave this body, then you will experience that. You will be drawn to that. Many people conceptualize heaven to be something of an ideal astral world. It's bright, it's beautiful, you are only around other people who are in harmony with you. All of that describes the astral region. But there are regions beyond that, as vast as the astral worlds and universes are, there is even a greater sphere of the causal. Causal means idea. And it is the ideal realm. You think of when you create something, if you are an architect, you start with an idea. Then you sit down with a pencil and paper, or today a computer, and you start to create it. You start to give it outlines. And so from the causal, or the idea, comes then a further quickening of spirit, and then the astral comes into being, bright and beautiful. It takes on a form for all the ideas that have been created before. And then out of that, the spirit again moves upon it, and it turns into a much more condensed form of energy. Atoms, electrons, neutrons, protons. And those then form the basis for everything that we see, everything that we experience here. And so this is a wonderful thing, but not to become so focused upon this material creation, to think that it is the all in all, that is, putting a graven image before the altar of God and worshiping it. This should not be so. Nor should there be any lesser gods, so to speak, any lesser ideas, any lesser forms. So this is what Master came to teach us. And during the retreat, we focused upon his life and his words. One of the books that I read from is The Flawless Mirror by Kamala. Kamala was a disciple of Master. She met him when she was still a teenager. She and her mother did. And Master would come to their home and stay for days on end. And it was a wonderful, wonderful relationship. And she wrote about it in this book. But I wanted to read to you about the towards the end of Master's life. And these are some letters that he wrote to Kamala. This is dated November 13, 1951. I have your letter of October 19th and remembered you and the group on the evening of the 23rd. I would have replied sooner, but have been away, enjoying the desert air for a while. Expect to return there sometime this week, and busy as usual with the phone ringing constantly. My heart is light because I am again working on my books. Was up until the early hours of this morning, writing. I am working on Genesis and extremely busy. It will be a great relief to complete a few more books, and I expect to keep at this while at the desert. Please write about your plans of spreading the work. How is it going? I am raising finances for you. This was for his help in the purchase of a church when we located one. Try to come at Christmas, can you? On the 23rd is meditation. On the 25th, 2 p.m., is dinner. You are both invited, she and her husband. So then he writes again, December 15th, I'm very happy to hear from you and to learn briefly of the progress of your work there. I was pleased to read the good news about the home which has been offered for the Berkeley meetings, which are to commence in the new year. It was interesting to note that you have a candlelight Christmas devotional service at the San Francisco Center tomorrow evening, and my thoughts will be there with you. Bob Raymer, who is the minister for Master, told an amusing story about when I met with him about how every time before he was to give a talk, as Master had asked him to do, that he would write to Master a telegram and tell him the exact date and time that he was going to give the talk, wanting to have Master's thoughts and blessings on him at that time. And then Master passed from the body, and he thought, well, what am I to do now? How am I to write him a telegram? So when he is preparing to give the talk, he would sit beforehand, and he would quietly commune with Master until he felt his presence. That was his telegram, and that was Master's response back to him. And once he felt his presence, then he would continue on to give the talk. I think that's a wonderful, wonderful story. Master continuing here, I received your letter regarding Mrs. Blank. I immediately began to pray for her. Please keep me informed about her condition, and tell her to keep her faith steady and to pray deeply and often, quote, Father, I am protected in the castle of thy omnipresence. I'm glad you and Edward are both coming for Christmas. I hope to be able to talk with you more in detail when I see you. I thought you would like to hear about her impressions of Master, and so I'm going to continue. We were at Mount Washington for the holiday season. Pre-Christmas, all-day meditation was spent in prayer, chanting, and silent worship, with hearts attuned to Christ. Paramahansaji meditated with us. He spoke of Jesus and his oneness with the Father, of his living presence, and how Christ may be born again within our consciousness. This special Christmas service, which highlights the holy season, is held in the SRF churches and centers throughout the world and is uplifting for all who participate. I've attended these meditations at Mount Washington as many times as possible during my lifetime. Christmas Day, Master sent word for us to come to his rooms, where Edward and I visited with him and received his thoughtful gifts. When we were seated at the dinner table, I took notes on the talk he gave in order to carry his message back to our members in Northern California. And I thought again of the privilege that was ours to be in the company of one whose life has exemplified the precepts of Christ. Master asked me to come on the following day to see him. At this time, Edward visited with the monks. He knew many of them and always spent time with the renunciate brothers when he came to Mount Washington. While I was with Master, we meditated together for a while. Then he talked to me of many things, especially concerning SRF activities. Time passed all too quickly. When the hour to leave had arrived, Master asked for Edward and then gave each of us a blessing. Reluctantly, we departed, with pronouns of respect and devotion. I was not to see my Guruji again, but I did not know this as I received his parting blessings. How overwhelmingly sad and shocked I would have been if I had but realized it. With all of his words preparing one, a veil seemed to screen my actual comprehension. When again in Oakland, I had a great longing to talk with Master. Although so recently with him, my mind was strangely demanding. It was as if my sense of urgency was an intuitive prompting. For a while, I was not then aware of it. This was to be the last time I would hear his voice while he is in his earthly form. I called long distance in the early hours of January 5th. It was his birthday. While we visited, he asked if I could return for a while. I mentioned the Kriya initiation in January and the class series that followed at the Berkeley Center. Those already scheduled plans blocked my perception of his expressed wish. I was later to learn, when my guru was no longer there, that I had missed a last precious opportunity to be with him. This brought an aftermath of remorse. My oversight assailed me with sudden force. It was like seeing in focus what had previously not registered. Such lessons taught through the pain of regret are well learned. Reminds me of what happened with Master when he went back to India in 1935-36. He was very busy and he traveled many places. Just before Sri Yukteswar left the body, he sent a telegram to Calcutta for Master to come immediately if he wanted to see him again. Master delayed staying overnight in Calcutta, and then left on the first train in the morning instead of that last evening train. Sri Yukteswar left the body during that night, and the deep, profound remorse that was in Master at that moment was tremendous, and it was one of the things when he saw Sri Yukteswar resurrected in Bombay Hotel that he was carrying that burden, that he had not responded to his Master quickly enough and gone immediately in order to see him for the last time and to be with him when he left this earthly body made of clay. These things happen at times, and it deepens our resolve. It clarifies our love when we have that kind of regret. It puts us in a state of mind of complete and total surrender, because we feel that we have not lived up to the highest light in that moment. If I had only known, if I had only responded. And so that deep adamantine determination comes to go beyond what is human, to tap into the purely divine and surrender ourselves 100%. This is a tremendous time, a tremendous thing that happens, and while it crucifies us in the human sense, it also purifies us and helps to lift us into that Christ consciousness. This letter is dated January 17, 1952. I was very happy to see you both at Christmas time. I missed you at the birthday party on the 5th. Please write me often with details regarding your central work, though I am unable to write you regularly due to lack of time. I hope everything you have planned is proving successful. I send my kind thoughts to both of you all the time. I have received a letter from the Consul General about joining with the celebration in San Francisco for the India Independence Day. This is the day that Master leaves his body. He's actually giving a talk, and it's the first representative of India to America. And Master is quite pleased that India has gotten its independence. I am busy getting the book ready for publication, so I'll be unable to attend. I've written to Mr. Aju today, but since I'm unable to attend the function myself, I'm sending my representatives, you and Edward, to represent me. Please convey to both the consul and his wife love and greetings. The enclosed card will give you the details. We attended the reception, which was given on that occasion by Mr. and Mr. Ahuja in their home in San Francisco. The Consul General and the Ambassador from India were planning to visit Master very soon. My Guru writes of this in the last letter to me. February 20th, 1952. Dear Kamala, I was happy to receive your letter of January 26th telling me about the reception for India independence. I have been snowed under with work on the book and been unable to take care of the letters that have arrived. The book has progressed very nicely, and I hope it won't be too long before it is ready for publication. I am working day and night toward that end. Master might have been surprised that it was in the 2000s before it did get published. The India ambassador to the U.S. is arriving in Los Angeles for a visit in March. I am planning to attend the reception at the Biltmore for him. He is coming to see me at Mount Washington and will also visit SRF Cafe and the Lake Shrine with Mr. Ahuja. I have been so busy writing on Genesis and international mail, I have been overwhelmed. But I was most happy, as always, to hear from you. Please write definitely what I can do. Do write me no matter how busy I am. With all love and blessings to you and Edward, Paramahansa Yogananda. Paramahansaji's expected guests arrived at Mount Washington on March. They went to attend the SRF Cafe and the Lake Shrine. Each plan Master mentioned in his letter carried out, including the reception at the Biltmore on March 7th in honor of the ambassador from India. This was the same hotel where my guru had stayed when he first came to Los Angeles in 1925. 27 years later, in 1952, Master again was at the Biltmore Hotel, but this time it would be the scene of his Mahasamadhi. Paramahansa Yogananda addressed the banquet guests that evening. Just as he called upon to speak, he turned to one sitting beside him and said, "Always remember, life has its beautiful roses and also its thorns, and we must accept both." In his talk, he spoke of the need for God in the world. He described the ideal combination of activity of the West and meditative qualities of the East. In concluding, he quoted from his poem, "My India." At the moment he had spoken the last words of the poem, he slipped from his earthly form. My guru, my dearest friend and mind, was gone. I was stunned with the inevitable shock of the news. He had escaped into vast infinite, but I knew only an emptiness. I had the sad duty of informing the class in Berkeley, where I imparted his teachings. I told of Master's passing, barely concluding before tears of grief took hold, the grief that silently filled the hearts of everyone. I think it's nice, wonderful to get these personal insights into the life of the great master. Sometimes great masters can seem larger than life, and indeed there is an aspect that is so. But they are also human. They have kindnesses. They may have quirks of personality. One time Mother said to me, she says, "You are a character." And I said back to her, "Well, that makes two of us." And she said, "What?" When she said it in that way, I knew I was in trouble. So I said, "That makes two of us." And she said, "I may call you a character, but you may not call me one." And it was a line of respect that she drew, that she wanted to draw my attention, never to be over familiar with her, never think of her merely as a human being. And this is absolutely true, that our minds must go to that level. Mataji used to say about Papa, she would talk to the people who come to see him. And she said, just because Papa sits with you and talks and laughs and tells stories, you treat him as an ordinary human being. But I can tell you, this is not the case. He is more than that. He is the universal spirit of God. You see, when we meet somebody, we can just be satisfied with what's on the surface. Or we can go beneath the surface and see what really is at the heart and spirit of an individual. If we delve deep enough, we will always find God there. God is that omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent force that is residing in each and every individual. It is our true nature. It is who we really are. But so many people don't exhibit that. And when you meet somebody who is exhibiting only ego, you become entranced with the ego. You start to interact with that individual only as an ego. And as a result of that, you lose your God consciousness. To really meet an individual, you look beyond those personality characteristics. You go to the deepest part of that individual and you recognize God within them. Every single individual, every particle of matter will eventually be withdrawn back into the heart and soul of God. Therefore, everything originates from God, is sustained in God, and is withdrawn back into God. Your perception of somebody as being separate from God, as their personality only, is colluding with their own mind, their own consciousness at the moment, that tells them that that is the key, that they are separated. But it is not the truth. It may be the perception of that individual, it may be your perception of that individual in that moment. But Papa felt that the greatest thing that he could do is to see God in every individual. By seeing God in them and not accepting anything less, he would quicken their evolution. He would help uplift their consciousness. And he proved it time and time again, as he wrote about in his travels around India, in the quest of God, in the vision of God. He was demonstrating how he did not accept anybody only as an individual. He saw them as God himself. One man that he was talking to says, you say that God is everywhere. God is in this room. Where is he? He's looking out with his two human eyes. Where is he? And Papa walked up to him and patted him on the chest and he said, he is right here. And the man melted. He had nothing to say to that. When someone speaks the truth, it carries with it a power. Somebody may not accept it in that moment. One wonders about the effect that Jesus had upon those that did not accept him. Pilate comes to mind about how this interaction with him. Well, what is truth, says Pilate, as a throwaway statement? But to Jesus, it was not a throwaway statement. Truth was a fact. Truth rose above all thoughts. Truth is a state of being. And Jesus stood there as an embodiment of that truth. And how did that affect Pilate down through time? There are some apocryphal stories about how his wife, Pilate's wife, had a dream. And she was deeply affected, and the dream had to do with Jesus. She was deeply affected by that. And it began to change Pilate as well, that he, through that interaction, began to change his life. And how many others may have changed their lives who, in the moment, couldn't accept him or turned against him. You think of the different disciples and how, out of fear, they ran away at the moment of crisis. And once again, even as Kamala or as Master, having a momentary lapse, that is deeply embedded within them, that they would never run away again. It is said that when Peter was crucified in Rome, that he asked to be crucified upside down. And you might ask why, and he said, as the Romans around him asked him why, and he said, my master was crucified right side up, but I don't even come close to who he is in spirit. So I don't want to be done in the same way that he was. So turn me upside down when you crucify me. And so they did it. And you reach back in time, in the time when he ran away from his master when he was arrested. And how deeply and profoundly that upset him. Some devotees of Mother were talking to Swami Satchidananda and talking about how they had fallen short as disciples. And Swamiji looked down and he said, we have all fallen short when it comes to following our guru. Such was his humility and the recognition that this is so, because as Sri Yukteswar said, as long as our activity is anchored in the human, we will always make mistakes. We will always fall short of the goal. It is only when we are anchored in the divine that we can be guided truly and know for certain that what we are doing is fulfilling the law of righteousness. So I encourage all of us to spend some time thinking about Master, to perhaps read the autobiography of the yogi again, to begin to go deeper into his spirit. One time Rajasi, after Master's passing, had a super conscious dream with Master, and he said, Master is so busy up in the astral realms. He is very busy here, but he's even more busy there. As he goes about teaching and helping to uplift souls everywhere, you just have to know that wherever Master is, he would seek it. He would seek to make it a heaven, to lift those who are around him into a higher heavenly consciousness. He is a power and a force to be reckoned with. And when God created him, he created quite well. I wanted to close with a few stories that Mother told. And this one is taken from a 1967 talk. I told you the story about the time somebody gave him the Lake Shrine property. He wanted to keep it a secret until he had everything ready to open to the public. I was sitting directly across from him at the luncheon table one day, and there was a big group of people around him, and he was talking away, and he'd been talking about this wonderful surprise. All of a sudden, his mouth opened and a couple of words came out. He looked at me so startled, he almost swallowed his tongue. I said to him, Master, is it that you almost divulged your own secret? And he said, yes. And another time, Mother talks, this is from a talk in 1960. I think the whole thing can be best summed up by one of Master's choice little stories. He told a story of a devotee who came to church one day and placed $100 in the collection plate. He knelt and he said a prayer and he went away. He wanted something of God. Then he wondered why his desire of his heart was not granted. The master said, You can't buy your way into heaven. The man expected to get his prayer granted by contributing $100 and just a prayer. It isn't done that way, Master said. You must go deep within your soul and contact the infinite. Only after you have contacted him should you ask him for the things that are closest to your heart. Yet, having become one with him, what is there to ask for? And this is the most wonderful story about Rajasi. Rajasi left body consciousness during the Kriya ceremony. I remember that one time Master was giving a Kriya initiation in Los Angeles. And when you practice Kriya over a long period of time, you can practice it very little before you go into ecstasy. And at a certain time during your development, the life force will immediately leave your body. Well, Rajasi was sitting in the front row, and Master was telling of the different devotees how to do Kriya. Well, Rajasi, because he had been doing Kriya for many years, was able to leave his body. He was a master in his own right, and he slumped immediately to the floor. Well, Bernard rushed over and pressed the jugular vein in order to bring the life force back into the body. The yogis have this method where they can return life to the body. So finally, when Rajasi went in front of Master to receive the initiation, Master laughed at him, and Rajasi had a bald head, and he patted his head, and he said, "Well, you left us for a while, didn't you?" And he laughed. It is nothing to be afraid of, you see, because the astral body is attached to the physical body by the spinal centers and also the navel, you see. And this long astral cord holds you to the physical body, and after a given time, you will return to the body. And if you have your full attention fixed upon God, there is absolutely no danger, no need to worry at all. And then Mother quoted from the Bible, "And when I saw him, I fell at his feet as dead. And he laid his right hand upon me, saying unto me, Fear not, for I am the first and the last." And the last story here. You will pick up many books that are masters, wherein they say that he talked with God, and God speaks with them. Now, I was down at Encinitas once, when Master was telling me about this beautiful temple that he had built down there. And he said, "I had the idea I wanted to build the second Taj Mahal. It was a beautiful thing, right at the edge of the cliff, overlooking the whole blue Pacific." And he said, "I had the idea that men from all over the earth would come here and worship, and my full concentration was upon serving God in that way. All of a sudden, one morning, I woke up and the temple had been pushed into the sea. I couldn't understand this. Did I not want to serve God? I was very angry with him," Master said. Imagine being very angry with God. And he said, "I told him about it. Then he looked at me wondering whether or not I would accept the statement. And he said, 'You know, I speak with God,' and he answers. And he said, 'God's words to me were, your full concentration was upon that temple. It was not upon me. And I destroyed that temple so that you might build the temple of God in the hearts of men everywhere.' Isn't that beautiful? I destroyed that temple so that you might build the temple of God in the hearts of men everywhere." Anytime we focus upon a truly realized master, they act as an open door. If somebody is only full of ego, then they are like a locked door. It keeps tight, and we only approach that personality. But with our guru lineage, any one of them, we can approach. And as we think on them, meditate upon them, read about their lives, read their words. We are lifted up into the consciousness from which they spoke, which they wrote, from which they operated out of. And so it is not blasphemy, it is not worshiping idols, in order to worship an aspect of God. The mind has to have something to focus upon. If it is not an image of God Himself, then perhaps it is a particular temple or a particular place on earth. But the mind focuses upon that because that's the nature of the mind. We cannot think of a God that is beginningless and endless because thought doesn't go there. We can only imagine what that might be. But it's only when we are lifted into the reality of that experience that we really know it. So we walk a fine line. I see that there are those that think of Master, and there are many who teach that he is the last guru, that he is the greatest. Every disciple feels that about their Master, and rightfully so. But if we make a fetish out of it, if we make too much of it, then it falls into a state of ignorance. We no longer see that Master as a conduit to higher consciousness. We now see them as an end in itself. We promote them in that sense. We think of them in that sense, and that becomes a limiting factor. Because the true Master doesn't come to take us to them. They come to take us to their Heavenly Father, even as Jesus did. So to go beyond that, to merge into it. Now some people are purely impersonal. I'm of a more impersonal nature myself. And I always thought of God as that living presence that is within me. And did not associate Him so much with personalities or images of any sort. But I have found in my time with going to God that there is a benefit to focusing upon particular images and aspects of God. Some are delightful. Some may or may not have any historical validity. There were those Christians in the early years, within the first 100 years, who said that there is no individual such as Jesus who ever lived. It is pure allegory, the whole thing. So from very early on, this is so, and that's very upsetting to some people who look at only the material aspect of the Christ Spirit, of Jesus as a manifestation of Christ. It is important that we recognize that all teachings will be in error until we gain the highest consciousness, because it is something of the mind. It's a mind construct. It is only when we go beyond mind, into pure realization, a pure state of consciousness, that we can, in reality, know the truth. So let us not limit our comprehension of God or any of the Masters until we have reached that higher state of consciousness, until we have entered into that purity, until there consciousness, their vibration, their words become our own, and we feel ourselves united with them in that pure vibration of God. And then, in that state, it is difficult to know what is mine and what is yours. It only feels as if there is God alone. That is all. That is all. And then you come back into a more dual state of consciousness. And you recognize that God is in this form, and in that form, and in all forms. And yet there is this sense of separation. But you also, because you are ever united in that cosmic consciousness, you also recognize that even those who are in a state of ignorance are also He. They are God as well. Each and every form is an expression of the divine consciousness. And when you know that, You feel the purity behind everything, even things that are in ignorance. You feel the purity of God inside of them. You think of a child, and a child who is making mistakes, who intentionally sets their will to do something. And you can see there a delightful element of life as they experiment with their own will, as they experiment with doing something naughty. And if you are not overly involved with it, you can sit back and you can smile at the whole play. Because there is nothing gained and there is nothing lost. It just simply is, and it's all a divine expression. So let us go forward from this moment forward, practicing seeing everything as that universal vision, always seeing that it is God's hand behind every single thing, positive or negative, that is going on in our life. And as a result of that, your mind becomes more and more purified. And eventually, that practice turns into reality. And you see, in truth, that God is. And that God is manifesting as everything in this entire universe and the universes beyond. Pranam to the God that is within you. Ask Him to bless you, not with good luck, but with His blessings. For He is the life, the truth, the reality of all and all and all. Masters and Guru Lineage, blessings be upon you.